From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, he had never set foot in Iraq, but a Detroit man was arrested by ICE, deported to Iraq, and now he's been found dead in Baghdad.
I believe that he begged them. I believe that he asked them not to do this. I believe that he pled his case to them, and that fell on cruel, deaf ears.
Finding care for aging members of the LGBT community.
They're not thinking about the fact that, you know, 8 out of 10 don't have adult children to help care for them, and that's the number one caretaker. They're not thinking about the fact that they're 3 times more likely to be living in poverty because of a lifetime of employment discriminations.
And Michigan's tribal communities work to reduce infant mortality.
We can change our whole course of history by breastfeeding one baby.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. His name, Jimmy Al-Daoud. This 41-year-old man was deported to Iraq in June. Even though he'd lived his entire life in Southeast Michigan, he didn't speak Arabic. He had diabetes and mental health challenges. Here is Jimmy in an undated video shared to Facebook talking about life on the streets of Baghdad.
And I don't understand the language, anything. I was sleeping in the street. I'm diabetic. I take insulin shots. I was throwing up, sleeping in the street, trying to find something to eat.
His family and friends say Jimmy Al-Daoud died Tuesday in Baghdad. Edward Bajoka is an immigration attorney who is a friend of Jimmy Al-Daoud's family, and he is with us now. Edward, what can you tell us about Jimmy's death, how he died and where he was found? What do you know?
Sure. So my understanding is that Jimmy died on Tuesday and was found in some temporary housing that his family had been able to secure for him in Baghdad. The cause of death, we believe at this point, is related to his diabetes and his inability to obtain insulin in order to treat his diabetes.
How did his family get the news?
A neighbor who was in his in the temporary housing apartment that he was in contacted his family and told them about his death and that he had found his body that morning.
Walk us through Jimmy's life. Tell us, where was he born and when did he come to Michigan?
Sure. So Jimmy was born in Greece, in a refugee camp in Greece. His family had previously fled Iraq. They fled that country because of persecution due to the fact that they were a part of the Chaldean Catholic ethnic and religious minority in that country. And so they fled to Greece, and Jimmy was born in Greece. He's actually never stepped foot on Iraqi soil and has never been to Iraq. He spoke no Arabic because he was pretty much, aside from the 6 months that he lived in Greece, born and raised in the United States. Jimmy suffered from some mental health issues. He was a diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. He was also a diabetic. His mental health issues caused Jimmy to lead sort of an unstable life for the majority of his adult life. He did have some issues with law enforcement. One of the convictions that he had that led to his deportation was a home invasion charge in which he was charged and arrested and convicted for having stolen tools from his neighbor's garage. So as far as home invasions go, not the most serious home invasion out there. So Jimmy's life kind of went along that path of being sort of a slave to his mental health issues and his diabetes. And I think both of those things combined to lead him to trouble with the law and eventually lead to his deportation and death.
And, of course, as we know, the Trump administration and ICE say they are deporting people who had committed crimes, and Jimmy was one of the hundreds of Iraqis who had those final orders of removal. When was Jimmy picked up by ICE, and where was he held?
Jimmy was picked up in June of 2017, along with a few hundred other Iraqi nationals that you had just mentioned. Jimmy had was originally taken to Youngstown, Ohio, where he was held at a private prison facility called the Northeast Ohio Correctional Center. And that's a privately owned facility that's used to house ICE detainees. So he remained in the custody of ICE from June of 2017 all the way up until December of 2018, when he was eventually released pursuant to an order from Judge Goldsmith in the Eastern District of Michigan, who was the judge presiding over the class action lawsuit of which Jimmy was a part of. Once he was released, his mental health issues sort of got the better of him, and he stopped fighting his case, stopped fighting his deportation. And again, I think that's a result of the mental health issues. The immigration court system, when it comes to people with mental health issues, is not prepared to protect these people. It's not built to protect these people. So in a criminal case, for example, if someone is found not competent to stand trial, there are rights and there are processes and procedures and laws that are in place to protect people who are not mentally competent to stand trial. Those things and those protections do not exist in immigration court. Even if a person is deemed to be not competent, they are still, by law, put through the process and can be ordered removed and actually physically deported, as was the case with Jimmy.
And when was Jimmy sent to Iraq?
Approximately 2.5 months ago from today.
And was there anyone at all there for him? An attorney there? Any family?
No one. Jimmy, as I mentioned earlier, had never himself stepped foot on Iraqi soil. His entire family has been in the United States for 40 years. And he knew no one in that country. He was through the intercession of some people at the ACLU and through some other folks, was able to get connected with some on-the-ground resources in Iraq to help him at least get some shelter and get into a safer position than what he was placed in by ICE. He was initially deported to a city called Najaf, which is in the south of Iraq. Najaf is a city that has zero Christian Chaldean population, never has had any Christian Chaldean population. It's a city that is considered a holy city for Shia Muslims. And currently, there's a significant presence of Shia militias in that city, many of whom are sponsored by Iran and are very hostile toward Westerners, toward the United States, and toward people who might be affiliated with the United States, and toward Christians. Right around the same time that Jimmy was deported, the United States pulled their embassy workers out of Iraq, citing dangers toward them from the Shia militias that were in that region. And so Jimmy was deported not to Baghdad or not to the north of Iraq, where he may have had a bit of a safer place to go, but was deported, right into the fire and the place that was the most dangerous.
Who chose that location?
ICE.
ICE chose it.
They chose it. They made all his travel arrangements. His family was not notified of any of this. The only way that they found out was when they received some communication for him from him through sort of a good Samaritan that found him and realized what position he was in and connected him to his family.
What was his life like while he was there? And particularly, was he able to have any contact with his family back here in Michigan?
So through that good Samaritan, and once we kind of found out where Jimmy was, the family was able to help him out somewhat. They were able to help him again through, this was a group effort. I mean, Heartland Alliance, ACLU of Michigan helped out with that, and some other groups that are there on the ground in Iraq helped get him out of that city of Najaf and into Baghdad, where they helped him his family was able to help him to get an apartment, some temporary housing, while they figured out, you know, what the next move was going to be for him. And so he did have a phone and was able to communicate with his family via, social media, messenger apps, and that sort of thing. But it was, it was tough the 2 months that he was there. He often complained that, you know, he just couldn't get his medicine. I don't know if he ever was able to get insulin the entire time that he was there. He was, of course, deported without any supply of insulin at all. And so, you know, he was at risk from day one. We don't know why ICE chose to do this to someone who was this vulnerable, why he was so high up on their list. And maybe that's the reason, because he was so vulnerable.
I want to go back to that video of Jimmy that was shot in Baghdad. Here he is talking about when he was arrested by ICE. Let's take a listen.
Well, they just wouldn't listen to me. They wouldn't let me call my family, nothing. They just said, you're going to Iran, and your best bet is to cooperate with us. That way, we're not going to send you off, or we'll put you on our commercial flight. I begged them. I said, please, I've never seen that country. I've never been there. However, they forced me. I'm here now.
Edward Bajoka, what do you think about as you hear those words?
I think that is exactly what happened. I think that ICE forcefully removed him from the United States against his will. I believe that he begged them. I believe that he asked them not to do this. I believe that he pled his case to them, and that fell on cruel, deaf ears, the ears of people who have absolutely no humanity and no compassion and no ability to discern right from wrong. This was wrong what they did. It didn't have to be this way. They didn't have to do it this way. And if you, as the video progresses, I think Jimmy, the video becomes darker, and I think Jimmy ultimately predicts his own death in this video.
Edward Bajoka, we want to thank you for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Coming up, we talk about the issues facing the Stonewall generation, baby boomers, and the LGBTQ community.
8 out of 10 don't have adult children to help care for them, and that's the number one caretaker.
That is next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They're called the Stonewall generation, the baby boomers who are LGBT. Some 4.7 million of these LGBT elders are going to need some kind of care and services by 2030. But will they face the kind of discrimination when they seek care in their old age that they grew up with? And are elder care facilities aware of and ready to accommodate needs of gay and transgender residents? We begin here with Philip Ojibwe.
My name is Philip Ojibwe. I live in Southfield, Michigan. I live at in an 8-story building that's mostly senior citizens. Most of the people that are my age, back then especially, I mean, you know, we're talking about the 70s, you know. I mean, we came through that time when you were in the closet. There was a closet, and you were best in the closet, and you didn't talk about the date you had in public. I had quit my job and had moved to Detroit, and I was right in the middle of the gay community. I, you know, got a nice house in Palmer Park. One of the bars that I had been going to occasionally was a block away, and it turned out that the publication I eventually started working for was next door to this bar that was a block away. You know, so Cruise Magazine was a weekly publication dedicated to the gay and lesbian community and covering that genre of stuff that was going on around town. It was a connection point, and I had upped the quality of the publication quite a bit just by covering things that, other than just saying Gigi's is going to have a dance night, you know, I mean, we had those kinds of little stories in there. But we also started covering, like, basically gay news, you know, good stuff that, that just wasn't available around. The people knew that if they read it in Cruise magazine, it was true. Basically, I had retired, and I was living in Royal Oak, and I was in the hospital for a long time with, well, I don't have a leg here, and that's where this foot ends, is right here. And then when all this happened with the surgeries and all that sort of stuff, I couldn't go back there because it was three steps up into the apartment, whether I went in the front door or the back door. So, you know, I needed something else, and I had checked some other places around the area as well. And this one just felt the best for me. You know, I particularly liked the fact that there was, that this wasn't just a white community, you know, and to see the diversity of people that were here, I thought, this looks like it might be a good place. I have run into people, you know, out in the community, and where are you living? And, oh, how is that place? And I tell them, you know, well, I'm not out there, but there's a number of people that are there that know that I'm gay, you know. It's like, kind of like on a need-to-know basis for the most part. The gay movement is of course, now on the front page of everywhere because of the 50th year of Stonewall and all that sort of stuff. So I've gotten questions about that, you know. So, I mean, it becomes a good talking point. There's an organization that meets at the Affirmations Community Center in downtown Ferndale. Senior Coffee Klatch is the name of the organization. We have about 40 to 50 people every Wednesday. It's very nice. I've become a major resource for them, too, because they start talking about something 15, 20 years ago, you know, and they all know, you know, that I was the editor of Cruise magazine, you know. So when I say, well, what really happened there is this, they take it as gospel. And I really did develop a relationship within the community, is that if Phyllis says it's that way, that's the way it was.
That was Philip Ojibwe in an audio postcard produced by Stateside's Bella Isaacs. We turn now to Kat Latosh with SAGE, the world's oldest organization focused on improving the lives of LGBT older adults. She's the founder of Latosh Consulting, which helps nonprofits by expanding diversity, equity, and inclusion. Kat, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So here the country is certainly being challenged by how we will care for and house the aging baby boomers. The president of the Human Rights Campaign, HRC, has said, and I'll quote here, all too often, LGBTQ elders do not receive the care and support they deserve. Why is this?
Well, I think that we've trained a lot of people in the state of Michigan in particular, and people just aren't thinking about the unique concerns and challenges facing LGBT older adults as they enter, say, a long-term care community. They're not thinking about the fact that, you know, 8 out of 10 don't have adult children to help care for them, and that's the number one caretaker. They're not thinking about the fact that they're 3 times more likely to be living in poverty because of a lifetime of employment discriminations. They're not thinking about the fact that they might not be legally married and less likely to have a partner to help care for them. So that person enters that setting sometimes more fearful. As you get older, you have a little more frailty. And if you're by yourself, you don't have someone to be there, to be your support, and it can become even more fearful. And people don't realize it, that folks are struggling with all those things as they enter. They don't ask the right questions. They don't find out, like, who's your family of choice? Who is it that I should call if you need something? And it's not just caretakers or people who are staff. If I move into a long-term care facility, I'm worried about the other neighbors.
The other residents.
The other residents. And staff sometimes have a hard time managing them as well. Sometimes we lose our filters as we get older. And, you know, we're hearing all across the state issues of senior bullying that are on the rise because people tend to lose their filters and say stuff maybe they wouldn't have said in another setting.
Okay. And, you know, as you talk about this, Kat, I am thinking of a trans woman that I've come to know who, you know, as she transitioned, is now completely rejected by her family.
Yep.
Common story?
Very common story. We have recently met a trans woman who, when she came out as female, she decided to come out after her partner had passed, her spouse, because she didn't want to hurt that person. Kids completely disowned her. She couldn't come out in her existing community because she was worried about being mistreated. So she moved some 2 hours to a new town. So here she is, 70 years old, in a town where nobody knows her, transgender, doesn't have children to help support her, most likely has lost a job or other means of financial support. So where is she living? How is she taking care of her own needs? It's a very scary prospect, especially for transgender older adults. You know, the Obama administration had a policy that if you received federal funding in housing, you couldn't discriminate based on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. The Trump administration has rescinded that. And we're already seeing like shelter situations, which are really not gender inclusive, particularly for transgender older adults, and they're more likely to be homeless. LA Times just recently reported a 22% increase in the number of transgender older adults who are experiencing homelessness. Older adults. Mm.
And then when you think here in Michigan, there is no civil rights protection.
Correct.
For LGBT people.
Correct.
How is that playing out in this situation with elder care?
Well, Michigan has not been kind of a on the forefront of LGBT rights. But I will say on the issue of LGBT older adult rights, we've been a bit of a pioneer. And I think that's mainly because of Sage Metro Detroit.
Okay, tell us how.
Sage Metro Detroit is a affiliate of the national organization. And we formed out of the LGBT Older Adult Coalition about 12 years ago now, and really recognized a number of us community leaders came together and said, hey, people are calling us and they're saying, Kat, lose my phone number because I'm moving into a long-term care facility and I'm worried that everybody will mistreat me. So don't call me. Don't email me. Take my address out of your mailing list. At the time, I was working at Affirmations, and we were getting these calls on the helpline. Also, where do I go live? I'm worried about being mistreated, discriminated against. I don't know where to go.
It sounds like people are almost getting pushed back in the closet if they go into
Very much so. And you can call it a choice. But if you're worried that you're going to be mistreated, that's not really a choice. You're doing something out of self-protection. And so we looked at ourselves as community leaders and realized we had absolutely no good referrals to give people. Like, we didn't even know where to send people. We didn't even have the first clue. So that was the beginning of us inviting people who did this work in senior services to come to the table and say, what can we do about this?
And I know you are now the Michigan Project Manager for the Long-Term Care Equality Index, the LEI.
Yes.
So, which is going to provide a very important tool for people. Tell us about this.
Yes. So the Long-Term Care Equality Index is a project that's been in the works with Human Rights Campaign Foundation and SAGE National, it's a partnership, to assess long-term care communities. That means independent living, assisted living, nursing care, hospice.
The
whole
spectrum.
Are living like institutionally or in an environment that set up is by someone else. This enables those communities an opportunity to assess their current policies and practices to make sure they are inclusive. Because even if I'm like, oh, you know, I can't force somebody to come out of the closet, and I may not want to when I'm like 70. I might say, well, it's none of your business. I might choose when I'm going to come out. But this allows agencies to provide an inclusive atmosphere. So I come in thinking, oh, this place is okay for me to come out. It's safe, and I can ask questions that are important to me about my identity.
So the evaluation of these places and the way they rank on the index can help people feel a security. So what does an LGBT-friendly long-term care facility or assisted living look like? What kind of policies? Mm-hmm. What are some examples you can give us?
Well, in Michigan, and this is one of the reasons, although we're a little behind the ball in some other areas on aging work, we're ahead of the game. And that's because of funding from groups like the Michigan Health Endowment Fund. So we recently did a broad-based project, ended up being multiple chapters, a Detroit area project working with three area agencies on aging, followed by most recently a project working with Grand Rapids, Saginaw, the UP. So testing it in very rural communities, but working with the area agencies on aging to set exactly that down. And one thing is really for leadership to look at their policies. What is your value system around serving LGBT older adults? Do you have sexual orientation and gender identity in your non-discrimination protections? Because we know they're not included in the civil rights law. So your organizational policy is your personal law, your organizational law. Do you have that policy on the books? Are you providing training for your staff? Do you have symbols around your agency that say, we're gay affirming? Maybe a rainbow flag sticker on the window. Whenever we train staff, we give out little rainbow flag lapel pins. Because if I'm going out to your home and I have my little name tag lanyard on and I'm a person in my home, I see that flag and it's an immediate symbol to me that this person is safe. I can say, hey, we don't have a will. Or I'm worried about what happens when I pass because my name's not on the house. Or my daughter is a lesbian and she's going to be coming to this place with me too. And I want her and her family to be accepted. You know, yeah. You name
so
it.
So many facets of that. I saw a statistic, Kat, that 85% of the long-term care facilities in our country are religiously affiliated.
That is a huge challenge. It's one of the things that we explored more deeply in our Michigan project because especially with some of the conversation in the country and allowing discrimination based on what they call deeply held religious beliefs. And yes, a lot of our long-term care agencies are religiously affiliated. And that can be really terrifying for someone who's LGBT because oftentimes LGBT people have been literally traumatized by the religion. You know, there's not much you can say to you're an abomination in the eyes of God. I mean, that's a terrible thing to say to somebody, and it really hurts. It's really traumatizing. So to then walk into a religiously affiliated organization and say, I'm going to be cared for by these people. We've heard of things called deathbed conversions, where people are, you know, asked to renounce their homosexuality on their deathbed. And that's horrifying. So people have these real fears. So yeah, this is a very important consideration. And many organizations may choose not to be LGBT affirming for that reason. So we're seeking out the ones who want to be, who really want to provide good care and compassion to all adults, including LGBTQ older adults. The Q we don't necessarily use so much with older adults because like religious experiences, the word queer has also been used to hurt them.
So what time frame are you looking at to get this survey done, long-term care equality index?
So the long-term care equality index, this project is a national project, and they commissioned a report to really look at long-term care industry professionals and say, what would be the best way to roll this out? So we already launched at the American Society on Aging Conference in April, and that's to take the pledge. We just want you to pledge to commit to care for LGBT older adults. And that means getting your leadership on board. And then second is, oh, what are you doing about it? So step two is the self-assessment. And that's in the process of being developed now. We have a national advisory council, and that includes senior membership organizations and long-term care community professionals and LGBTQ community organizers. So once people take the self-assessment, then they'll get a sense of, how am I doing? Oh, I'm not so good. I'm really good on policies, but oh, we're not doing any marketing. Like none of our pictures show any kind of LGBTQ-ness. So let's improve there. And they'll give people some direction and guidance. Third step is for them to actually take the LEI, which will be a survey. And like HRC's many other indices, they have a corporate equality index, they have a healthcare equality index, all which list out the inclusive places in America and say, this is where you can go and expect inclusion. We will have a similar one for long-term care communities. So if I'm planning for mom or dad, or aunt or uncle in Utah, I can look nationally. I live in Michigan. They might be in Utah. I can look at that list and say, oh, this place has been through this. I can feel safer with them going here. Likewise, if I'm just looking by myself, I can go online and search for local institutions.
It's going to take a while to do that. Let's talk about people right now listening to us who are agonizing over what their elders, they are going to need care.
Yeah.
Who can they turn to for assistance right now?
Well, in Metro Detroit, we have something called the Rainbow Resource Guide. And it lists, we have worked over the past 5 years to develop a list of referrals that are LGBT inclusive. And there's coding. So it'll say everyone who's in the guide has made that commitment to care. And we've also vetted, do you have policies in place? Have you provided training? And we have little icons by each one. So if I'm looking, I can tell what level of work that organization has done to serve me best.
And so how do people find this?
It's online at our website, sagemetrodetroit.org, under resources. And that's been a great, great guide. With the Long-Term Care Equality Index, that'll be available online next year, I believe, with some of the resources that are available. And I will say, because of our statewide work, there's a resource guide in Grand Rapids in the whole area. And these are like seven county areas, and one in the Saginaw Bay City area, and one in the Upper Peninsula, all that are reachable by going to sagemetrodetroit.org.
Kat LaTosh, who's with SAGE and also the founder of LaTosh Consulting, which works with nonprofits and helps them to expand diversity, equity, and inclusion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the old shuttered Buick City plant in Flint could get new life from an unexpected source, India's Mahindra Automotive.
They are one of five finalists for the new next generation United States Postal Service delivery truck. And basically what they're saying is if we can get that contract, we can definitely build product at a place like Buick City. We're going to need a spot there.
That is coming up right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's been 20 years since General Motors pulled the plug on its assembly plant in Flint. But today there are signs of new life for the 364-acre Buick City site. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here. Daniel, tell us, who is looking at building vehicles in Flint?
It's an Indian car company, Mahindra. It's called Mahindra North America. And it is currently building off-road vehicles in a small facility in Auburn Hills. The product's called Roxor. It looks very much like a Jeep. In fact, Mahindra, the parent company in India, had the contract from Willys Overland at the after the end of World War II to build the product for Willys, which is, of course, the progenitor of Jeep. In India, and is still building it there. So they've kind of modeled it after that, and people, of course, immediately jump all over to the trademark violation. But nevertheless, they're looking to get into the U.S. commercial vehicle business. They are one of five finalists for the new next generation United States Postal Service delivery truck. And basically what they're saying is if we can get that contract, we can definitely build product at a place like Buick City. We're going to need a spot there. But they're also saying that if they don't get the contract, that they still want to enter that market. They think that given what's developing in shared use and delivery systems, people getting their groceries delivered to them and all sorts of other things that we've always gone out and bought out in the marketplace and out in the economy that will be delivered to people's doorsteps. So I think there's going to be a real market for delivery trucks that are rugged and made to last. And to develop cars and trucks for the Indian market, they have to be rugged because of the conditions there.
So this is the kind of thing you've talked about, this transition from all of the personally owned cars into fleets.
Yeah, and I think there's another thing here that's very significant. This would be the third time that an upstart automaker takes over an existing automaker's plant. At the same time we're talking about this, with the Detroit News broke a story at the end of last week that a company has been formed in Ohio called Lordstown Motors Corp that would take over the Lordstown site from General Motors and work with a partner to build an electric vehicle for the potential postal contract. And if they're not, they would be building other kinds of vehicles in that plant. And thirdly, Rivian Automotive, which is an electric truck maker out of Plymouth, now owns the old Mitsubishi plant in Normal, Illinois. And they are planning to build electric pickups in that facility. It's a very interesting turn of events here as we're seeing kind of Auto 2.0 come along, and some of these guys are targeting these properties that were at one time, certainly in the case of Buick City, of course, exceedingly iconic about what the Detroit auto industry was all about.
So what is it that Mahindra likes about this plant site in Flint, the old Buick City site?
They like the story. You know, the site has got some environmental remediation work that's continuing to be done on it. They may get to a point where they got to put a slab of concrete on the whole thing. But they've told me that that would not stop them from going ahead. It might limit them in terms of some landscaping and things like that. But it wouldn't get in the way of them building an assembly operation. They're saying they would have up to 2,000 jobs in the first 5 years, and it would grow thereafter. They would consolidate all their manufacturing up there, take the Roxor currently being built down here in Auburn Hills, move it up there. Their headquarters would stay in Oakland County, but they love the story. They love the fact that this is a historic site that could be repurposed, that they could help Flint in some way by their presence and being involved in the community. And I think it's quite a symbol if they can make it happen.
How far along have things gone?
They're in a due diligence process right now. They're really focused on continuing the environmental remediation so they can get an understanding of just what that entails and what it's going to cost. And the other thing is, frankly, the incentive package. They are not going to do this without an incentive package of some kind from state and probably local authorities, just like we saw happen with FCA in Detroit, mm-hmm. Ford with its acquisition of the train station in Detroit as well. That's always a component here. And I think the view is if Michigan is competitive and if all things are equal, they're definitely going to do this project in Michigan.
It makes you kind of wonder, if this all comes to be and mm-hmm. this Mahindra plant starts rolling out vehicles in Flint and providing these 2,000 jobs over 5 years, what else that could attract to Flint?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I think one of the things that's interesting over the last couple of years, and we've been talking about this off and on for some time, there was an assumption 3 or 4 years ago that in the battle between Silicon Valley and Detroit slash the traditional auto industry, Silicon Valley was going to win and the traditional auto industry is going to be left as a heap on the side of the road. I think that's clearly developing into that's not the case. And also you have startups that are coming in and saying, we want to be where this expertise is. We want to be in places where there's a tradition of building vehicles. That's why Lordstown Motors Corp. wants to be in Lordstown. Yes, it's a union shop. Yes, it's a union town. But basically, they're saying, we want the expertise that's here. Mahindra's taking a little different tack, saying, we want the pedigree here. We want the history here. We want to be part of this. Because, by the way, This is a company from an Indian automaker. There's never been an Indian automaker that's competed in the United States at any level. Mahindra does do farm tractors in the United States, and it does do off-road vehicles, but it's never done anything on the road. This is a bid for legitimacy. This is a way to say, hey, we can play too. We can play as well as the rest of you guys. And what better place to do it than in Southeast Michigan, in a Flint, in a Detroit, you name it.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's talk butterflies. Butterflies are disappearing, and soon many species will be gone forever. That's the argument MSU professor Nick Haddad makes in his new book, The Last Butterflies, A Scientist's Quest to Save a Rare and Vanishing Creature. Our book's contributor Keith Taylor has this review.
There's something special about butterflies. They have charisma. It seems that everyone who pays even the least bit of attention is drawn at one time or another to the flittering of butterflies across a field or through a backyard, even if they can name only with difficulty a monarch or a swallowtail. Like hundreds of thousands of other kids, I joined the Monarch Watch 50 or 60 years ago and attached tiny tags to the edges of butterfly wings so scientists could trace the migration patterns of these most majestic of butterflies. It was my first taste of what has come to be known as citizen science. Clearly, Nick Haddad, the author of this wonderfully informative new book, was one of those most deeply attracted to these delicate insects. They have shaped his life. Now he's a professor of biology at Michigan State University and senior territorial ecologist at MSU's W.K. Kellogg Biological Station in Gull Lake, northeast of Kalamazoo. Much of his recent work has focused on the rarest surviving butterflies, the ones that, as he writes, fly dangerously close to extinction. When comparing the tiny creatures he studies to other animals listed as endangered, he says that the collective weight of all individuals of the five rarest butterflies that I discuss in this book would weigh only 3 pounds, 5 ounces, as much as one panda's paw. Hadad has that rare ability to make difficult science accessible to those of us who are not trained in the nuances of ecological quantification. And he does so without talking down to us. I've checked some of his references to leading scientific journals and realize he has done the work to translate that language into one we can all understand. And he has done that because of his overwhelming sense of urgency. He writes, "Global habitat loss and climate change have relegated each species to minuscule land parcels, areas as small as a single golf course or even a football field. I have found rare butterflies in unexpected places, their populations restricted to artillery ranges or beaches or backyards." Habitat loss to human uses is, of course, the big problem. But Hadad's research in natural population dynamics has taught him that the issue is more complicated than that. Every habitat, whether marsh or dry field, has its own kind of natural disturbances, each of which might be absolutely necessary to the creatures who live there. Near the end, he admits that the rarest butterflies produce no measurable value to human economies or to ecological systems. Still, they remain important for something even more than their exquisite beauty, although that is not insignificant. These butterflies reveal the diversity of threats to nature. Perhaps they have become the canaries in our collective global coal mine. At the end, he finds his own conclusion, and by then he has convinced his readers, or this one anyway. Saving the rarest butterflies in the world requires one guiding principle. Humans should not be the cause of their extinction.
Was writer Keith Taylor with a review of Nick Hadad's book, The Last Butterflies, A Scientist's Quest to Save a Rare and Vanishing Creature. For every 1,000 Native American babies born here in Michigan, more than 14 don't reach their first birthday. That's triple the infant mortality rate for white babies. But tribal communities in Michigan are working to change that story. Stateside's April Van Buren reports.
Is that okay? Is that on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Certified lactation consultant Cami Goldhammer stands at the front of a classroom on the Lake Superior State University campus.
We're going to have you partner up. You'll need one baby. You can use your real baby or a baby doll, whatever you'd like.
She's here to train around 3 dozen women as breastfeeding counselors. Angie Chanos picks a doll dressed in a light blue onesie and matching hat. She places its face over a colorful cloth breast that she's holding on top of her shirt.
It feels like he's hurting my nipple a little bit. I don't know, it just seems like he's struggling.
Okay, do you see any milk coming out?
Sage Hegdahl is the second voice you hear there, and she's coaching Chanos on how to get the baby to latch onto the breast.
Is he latched on?
Yep.
How is that feeling for you?
A lot better.
Good.
Yep. He's got a big old mouthful now.
Oh, that sounds great.
Chanos and Hegdahl, like all the other women in the room, are indigenous. Hegdahl is Mohawk from the Bay of Quinte in Ontario. Chanos is a member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. The latest state data show the infant mortality rate for Native American babies in Michigan increased nearly 30% from 2013 to 2017. And it's important to note that the data set for this population is a lot smaller than it is for other ethnic groups. So it's hard to say how significant the jump is in the long term.
But any jump for us is concerning because it just shows that we're not moving things in the direction that we want.
That's Rayanne Madison. She's a member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe, and she works in the Maternal and Child Health Department at the Intertribal Council of Michigan.
So my question is not so much slicing and dicing the data and the numbers. My concern is, why is this happening to us and what we need to do about that?
Madison says babies in Native communities face a disproportionately high risk of sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. And that's where breastfeeding comes in. Research shows babies who are breastfed for at least 2 months are half as likely to die from SIDS than babies who switch to formula earlier. But Native mothers are less likely than white women to make it to the recommended 6 months of exclusive breastfeeding. That disparity, Cami Goldhammer says, is driven by a long history of colonialism and racism.
So we talk a lot about historical trauma or intergenerational traumas, which is trauma that's passed down from generation to generation, that has affected really all Native people.
Goldhammer is Sisseton Wahpeton, and she grew up in Seattle, where she's now a lactation consultant. She says in cultures around the world where breastfeeding is still the norm, women have all the same problems nursing as they do here.
But what they have is grandmothers that breastfed and that can serve them. And that's something that we don't necessarily have as a whole in our communities now.
For centuries, Indigenous people in North America were forced from their homelands by white settlers. Starting in the late 19th century, the U.S. and Canadian governments started forcibly separating Native children and their families. They were sent to off-reservation boarding schools, where speaking their Native language or practicing their culture was forbidden. Physical and sexual abuse was not uncommon. And the trauma of that history is still being felt today, says Goldhammer.
And so bonding or attaching with our babies, being that close to our babies, having our baby be that dependent on us can sometimes be very overwhelming when you have a trauma history that goes back 500 years.
The work Goldhammer is doing is part of a growing movement for Indigenous birthrights. And it's not just about breastfeeding. In Michigan, tribal communities are also reviving traditional practices around pregnancy and postpartum. There's a focus on improving nutrition by eating traditional foods, and communities are hosting cradle board building workshops for new parents. These curved wooden boards are how Anishinaabe families have carried their babies for centuries, and the ancient tradition is a model of a hugely successful modern public health initiative. Cradle boards keep the baby on their back to sleep, and that significantly reduces the risk of SIDS.
Something that's really profound to me is that 1 year ago, when you walked into one of our community buildings, you wouldn't have witnessed mothers and families with cradle boards.
But that's changing, says Dee. She and her husband had their first child, a girl, this March. Dee is from the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. She asked that we use only her first initial to protect her family's privacy. Before placing her daughter on the cradle board, Dee swaddles her in what's known as a moss bag. She coos and gives her daughter little kisses as she ties the bag's leather ribbons.
We do it in like little steps, because it can't be rushed. She'll yell at you.
Then she secures the moss bag by weaving leather straps back and forth through holes on either side of the cradle board.
She can, like, rest and then take in the beauty of her cradle board and what she has on it and then look beyond her cradle board at the world. It's pretty awesome.
The next day, Dee and her husband will host their families for a traditional naming ceremony. They'll celebrate her daughter's Native name with plates of berries and fish in honor of the Bear Clan. Later on, the family will bury the baby's placenta in a special spot, close to their home on Lake Superior.
And they say wherever you plant that placenta, that like grounds your baby to that place.
The Anishinaabe, like other Indigenous people in North America, believe that what happens to them today will go on to impact the next seven generations.
So we say that things that were experienced by our ancestors many generations ago, we can still be healing from those effects.
But Rayanne Madison says that is actually a really good thing. Reviving traditional pregnancy and postpartum practices isn't just a way to connect to the past. By rooting children in the culture of their ancestors, Madison says, Native communities can change what happens to the next seven generations.
So we say that every drop of breast milk is, for instance, something that can heal our DNA. We can change our whole course of history by breastfeeding one baby.
For Michigan Radio, I'm April Van Buren.
And that's our program. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.